We had a classmate at Manchester College, now university, who we called Air Force George. Now, George was a little on the eccentric side. He tended to hang around with a small group of people, mainly those who worked at WBKE, the mighty radio station of Manchester College. He stood out from the rest of the student body because he didn't look like the rest of us, especially the guys, because those were the days when most of the guys wore long hair, including yours included down to here. But George's hair was short cropped, buzzed on the sides. And when he moved across campus, it was more like he was marching instead of walking. George liked to think of himself as a ladies' man, but that didn't turn out so well because I don't know if any of the great hot women who were all that interested in him, mainly because he talked nonstop about military history. We called him Air Force George because he most of the time wore an Air Force flight jacket that we assumed he had purchased at a military surplus store. After graduation, we jokingly said he will be the graduate we hear least about in the future. And so you can imagine our surprise when he showed up at our last reunion. What you been up to, George? Well, upon graduating from here, I learned to fly F-18 fighter jets. He said, I was a master sergeant for the 21st Wing of the Alaska Air Command. I was head of the military support team for President Carter's visits to Alaska. I was the official military photographer at Ronald Reagan's second inauguration. He authored a book and several award-winning magazine articles in military trade magazines. He wrote volumes of information for Air Force public relations. He was promoted to a lieutenant colonel and a wing director of aerospace education for the Civilian Air Patrol. He retired 13 years ago with a sweet military pension, and for the last 13 years, he has been the constituent relations manager for the New York State Senate. And did I mention that he has a wife that looks like she stepped off the cover of Vogue magazine? There was Air Force George. He had done okay. Had he made bologna salad out of our characterizations? Maybe. Were we just a little envious of George's success? Perhaps. Just a little. Were we humbled when we had some introspection and thought about our own accomplishments? Possibly. I do know that some of us gathered over in a corner of the room, and then one of us spoke for the rest of us. And he said, "Who does he think he is?" In our text from Mark last Sunday, Jesus healed two people. He healed the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. And he healed the dying 12-year-old girl who was the daughter of a prominent Jewish leader named Jairus. And today, as this story continues in Mark, Jesus goes back to his hometown. You know, he didn't leave home until he was 30. Remember, he had a Jewish mother. And after 3 years in ministry, he came back to his hometown. And people were thrilled. The hometown boy has come back, and they asked him to teach in the synagogue. And so everyone in town showed up. And before the service began, you could overhear the buzz. Oh, he was such a nice boy. Yo, I had him in Sunday school, you know. He had destiny written all over him. Isn't it nice that he brought 12 of his friends all the way to Nazareth just to express his appreciation for all that we had done for him? And as Jesus began to preach, they were blown away. What a command of Scripture! Such wisdom and authority! And they were justifiably proud because he was one of them. But it became very clear that he had now moved very far beyond them. The Sunday school pupil was now a master teacher, the likes of which they had never heard before. And then things got sour. Hey, wait a minute. Isn't he the carpenter? Yeah. Yeah, he was the guy who was framing walls 3 years ago. Say, isn't that his mom over there and his brothers and sisters? Yeah. That's who that is. Now what happened? Maybe he hadn't fussed over them as they felt they deserved. Maybe they didn't like what he said because it made them feel so small. And one of them, speaking for the rest of them, said, "Who do you think you are?" And Jesus said, "Prophets are not welcome in their hometown or even in their own families." After I had been in ministry 10 years, my home church asked me to come back and preach for the church's 75th anniversary. Ah, what the heck. So I went, and I received this wonderful, warm reception, and it was so good to be back home, and they seemed glad to have me. Two of my Sunday school teachers who were in their 90s were there. It was a grand event, but I noticed something after the service. People thanked me as they went through the line, but no one mentioned anything about what I said. There seemed to be a distinctly different mood before worship and after worship. And I wonder, what's going on here? And as the potluck was winding down, a young lady sat down beside me and said, "Thank you for that great sermon. Finally, somebody said something." And she said, "We're really glad you're here. And you know, you lovingly said what I've been saying ever since I became a member of this congregation. With a lot of polish, you said what I've been saying in three words." So what? "Change or die." Well, I guess I kind of said that, but I said it so nicely that they should have accepted that. His mom and dad and I are leaving the church. There's a group of people over in the parking lot, and I swear I overheard one of them say, "Who does he think he is?" And I imagine the front page of the Marian Star with this article, "Former Marian Pastor Returns to Warm Welcome and Tepid Farewell." A prophet is not welcome in his hometown. And the great tragedy of this story from Mark is that Jesus couldn't do a thing there. He could do no works of power among his own people. Now, if you read the story right after this, this is the story of the disciples going out to spread the mission, and they have tremendous success. And Jesus can't do anything because of his hometown crowd's attitude and because of their unbelief. And Mark says Jesus was amazed. Robinson says there is a warning here for us all. He said, "Don't let the blessing of an earlier companionship blind you years later to a true messenger of God. During my senior year in college, I had several sessions with this freshman who was just learning to play the guitar. I showed him a lot of chord formations, and I graduated, and we went our own ways. About 25 years passed, and I'm lying on the couch watching a Vince Gill concert on television. And as the camera pans around to the members of his band, I thought, man, that guy looks familiar for some reason, but there's no way I would know him. And then in between songs, Vince Gill was introducing the members of his band, and over here on guitar and vocals, Mr. Jeff White. Boy, did I gush with pride. Jeff has recorded albums with Emmylou Harris and the bluegrass goddess Alison Krauss. Back in April, I watched a webcast of Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion. They featured a new hot bluegrass band called the Earls of Leicester, featuring the world's greatest dobro player named Jerry Douglas. And who should be playing guitar? Jeff White. Well, a couple weeks ago, on Friday night, I stayed up late. I was watching the Palladia Network. It's a rock channel that all they play are concerts. And I was watching the Crossroads Blues Festival from Chicago. Oh, and there's Vince Gill, and he was playing with the Woodstock guitar legend Alvin Bishop and Elvis Presley's longtime guitar player, James Burton. And over there, Mr. Jeff White. And I said to myself, who does he think he is? Did Mr. White thank me at all for setting him on this path to stardom in the music world? No. And am I envious of his great success? Slightly. Okay, what's the hottest shade of green envy you can imagine? I mean, I was the teacher. He was my student, and now he has gone off into the stratosphere, so far beyond my skill level. Of course, this is tongue in cheek. I am very glad for Jeff. And if he should come to Fort Wayne with his band to have a concert at the Embassy Theater, I'm going to be the first in line. I share that story because envy, you know, is one of the seven deadly sins. It's a powerful one. It's one to which we are all too susceptible when someone we knew back in the day, someone we thought we knew, becomes successful. And the folks from Nazareth knew Jesus, but he wasn't their boy anymore. He was God's messenger. And it was their amazing attitude and their unbelief that rendered Jesus Christ, the Son of God, powerless to do great things in their midst. Who are these people today? Well, they're sitting in pews and in adjustable seating in churches all over the world. You know, we liked him when he was a baby. We liked him when he was a precocious 12-year-old. Then he had to grow up and start being very demanding. Follow me, he said. Take a stand. Choose sides. Live against the stream. Live like me and love like me. All of those demands, and he promised to dwell within us and do great things among us. He gave us such a generous slice of his own power, and yet we don't expect all that much. We create the list of things that we want for our church building. and not a list of things that we want God to do through us. We got it all wrong. His hands are tied and he is amazed by our unbelief. I heard a church consultant talk about going to speak at what once was a tremendous church noted all over the country for its great preaching and its outstanding involvement in the community. Now it was a gray-haired congregation of 50 people worshiping in a huge sanctuary. And as one of the leaders of the congregation was giving him a tour of the facility, he said, "I saw it 25 years ago. That's when we started the downward spiral. And I thought the church doors would have been closed by now. But boy, was I wrong. Because I guess you could say there is a revival going on here. We've changed. Today we have 500 people on a Sunday, new people, young people, old people, rich people, poor people, white people, black people, straight people, gay people. And oh, do they love each other." "Well, what happened?" asked the consultant. The man thought for a moment. He said, "Well, it wasn't all because of our new pastor, but boy, he helped make a difference." "And how was that?" he said. "He got us serious about the Bible," the man said. "We started to really study it. He led wonderful Bible series, but best of all, he told us he could give the entire message of the Bible in just 6 words. I said, "Oh, really? What were the 6 words? The man put his hand on his chin and he grinned. "I am God and you're not." And that became the mantra of the church. "I am God and you are not. Put away your paltry little list. Because I am God and you are not." There are many churches, perhaps ours included, that are living on their collective memory of the way it used to be. They are more focused on their shrinking membership and their deteriorating buildings and not on the building of the body. They have forgotten that the only source for the church's existence is the energy and the power and the life of the loving, life-giving power of God. That church had been humbled. Their pride had been exposed. Their spiritual poverty had to be confessed. And every step of the way they reminded one another, "I am God and you are not." I suggest that we put a box just outside the door and have in big letters, "Egos." And every Sunday when we come to church, we would drop in our ego and our pride and our stilted vision and our grudges and our negativity and our conflicts. And after you do that, you walk in the door and a greeter is going to give you a baseball cap with the letters embroidered across the top, "I am God and you are not." That way, every time you look at somebody, you're going to remember. And then I would propose that at the heading of all the worship bulletins and the refrigerator news, on the minutes of the meetings of the leadership team and the congregational business meeting, we stamp in big letters, I am God and you are not. You know, I pray more than anything that we could amaze Jesus. And, you know, there are just two ways of doing that. Would you stand, please, and open your insert? This is a beloved song to me because I sang it with 300 people inside a 1,400-year-old cathedral on an island off the coast of Scotland. The song was being directed John Bell. There it is. John Bell, who started that community. It was an awesome experience. Let's see how close we can come, okay?